You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal and I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Joining me today to talk about the Democratic National Convention is Nick Rodriguez. Nick is a government consultant in Washington, D.C. and the host of the Prophetic Politics podcast. Also, Nick does live in D.C. and attends Anacostia River Church. Nick, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right, Coyle. How are you?
We're fine. Things are not as shut down as they used to be. I don't know if that's true for you guys or not.
No, it's true over here too. Yeah.
Right. And I know DC got hit pretty hard, so they've been slower opening up than we have.
Yep, for sure.
If the name Nick Rodriguez seems vaguely familiar to our listeners, that's because 4 years ago, he was on the show as the defender of Hillary Clinton. I won't say Hillary Clinton super fan because I don't think such a person exists, but...
They exist, but that's not me.
Encouraging us to consider voting for a Democrat, and I want to open by asking if at least the vote Democrat mentality still stands. Nick, would you encourage Christians to consider voting for the party that openly celebrates the mass execution of infants and has declared warfare on at least the First and Second Amendments of the Constitution, or have you changed your mind in 4 years?
Well, Coyle, when you put it that way.
I will say similar things next week, by the way, about the Republicans.
I guess what I'd say is I know this is a bit of a cliche, but we actually just talked about this on the podcast, like, who are we thinking of voting for? Of the three of us who host our podcast, I'm the only one who's kind of got my mind made up that, yes, I'm voting for Biden and Harris come November. So I would encourage that, but I wouldn't frame it as vote for the Democrats, like because they're Democrats or because I like the Democratic Party. I would say in this election, it makes sense to vote for Biden and Harris. And if anything, I think I don't think I was much of a party loyalist when I came on 4 years ago, but I'm probably even less of one now. And I think that if you think about sort of, it's funny, I was talking with some friends the other day about like, what does your vote actually mean? And I was saying, it is defensible to think about your vote as a kind of pure statement of your own values that you do not want tainted, as it were, in terms of what you say with your vote. If that is true, you are likely voting for nobody, or you're voting for like a very minor candidate, right? Like who kind of really, really just fits with your preferences. And I think that's a defensible choice. Like if that's how you want to think about your vote. And I think what I said 4 years ago and I still believe today is, for the most part, my philosophy is, your vote is an instrument, right? It is something that is meant to accomplish a certain objective. And what it ends up accomplishing is mixed because you don't agree entirely with one party or with the other. So you noted, right? Like, I am not pro-choice. I am not for abortion. So I do not like the Democratic Party or Biden or Harris's stance on abortion. I think the First and Second Amendment stuff is more complicated, but we can talk about that if you like. But for other reasons, yes, which we can get into, those are who I'm voting for this time around.
That's fair. I don't know who I'm voting for this time around. I didn't vote Libertarian last time because they had kind of a crackpot at the top of the ticket. And this time, the only thing I know about the Libertarian candidate is that she got bit by a bat. And I don't know that that's a reason to vote for or against someone.
Right.
Maybe.
Fair enough. I will try to make the case to you for instrumental voting, Coyle.
Right. I am not on the fence in terms of voting Republican or Democrat for the presidential candidate. I'll certainly light my ballot on fire before I'll vote for either of them. But beyond that, I haven't decided who I'm going to positively vote for. That's not what we're actually talking about today, although I suppose it's definitely related. We're talking about the Democratic National Convention, which is unique, largely because of the pandemic, right? It was entirely online this year, or primarily online. It's not really true that it was entirely online. There were people in the rooms where the speeches were being given who were socially distanced out and so on. But it was definitely a different feel. Nick, can you give me just your initial reaction to it? Give me sort of your big picture overview, and if there's anything you want to dive deep into, we can do that. What did you come away with from the convention?
Yeah. So let me start with kind of more minor things, and then I'll work my way to some more major things. But a couple things stood out to me. Number one is, I think a lot of people have been saying this, and I don't think you need to think about it from a perspective of a party, but I really actually thought it was great and don't think we should go back to having four-day in-person conventions, even when the pandemic situation allows it. That was much more efficient and much briefer.
Nick.
Seriously. No. I don't know. I mean, I just there was just sort of less of the pageantry, less of the sort of stuff that kind of just gets in the way, less of the theater, and more of it's all right, what can we pack into 8 hours that we'd really want the voters to hear? And even 8 hours is a good long time, right? Like 2 hours for four nights. So anyway, as a format, I personally preferred that. So that's one small thing. I guess the second thing I would say is, I think that conservatives are going to sort of look at the way that a lot of the choices made around who was speaking and when deliberately took a lens of kind of, you know, call it representational equity, right? Around like, they're just going to be people from all over the sort of spectrum of diversity, right? And I think it's easy if you lean right to sort of, to clown on that a little bit. I will tell you, as a mixed race person whose, you know, grandparents were all immigrants and who, grew up on the West Coast and lives on the East Coast and is married to a Haitian American and is about as like mixed up as you can get. And is also, by the way, you know, an evangelical Christian. I got to tell you, I had probably my most emotional reactions were these moments when you were sort of seeing kind of those deliberate attempts at making sure that all of the country was represented, whether it was in the sort of the roll call of states, or in thinking about the just the different sort of speakers, right? Like as a parent of a child with special needs, to see, a child with a stutter on the fourth night of the convention, there to talk about Joe Biden, but also just being there. You know, those were all really, I think, touching moments. They're one reason why I sort of like that. That's an aspect of the values of this party that I do appreciate. And I think that if you think about the idea of Genesis 1 and the image of God in all of us, for me, I think that's an important expression of that. So I probably got more emotional during those moments than I thought I would, but there it is. And I guess the third thing I would say is, if you look at the sort of marquee speeches that took place, particularly like Michelle Obama, Barack Obama, and then Joe Biden himself, what I would say is there was a difference in tone this time versus 4 years ago, if I'm remembering 4 years ago. 4 years ago, there was half of a sort of a, we're not even taking Donald Trump seriously, and I can't believe, you know, you guys are thinking of voting for this guy. And there was some over-the-top stuff, but most of what was said in those speeches was pretty serious. I've never been sort of frightened by something Barack Obama said before, but he was sort of like, guys, our democracy is at stake here, which is pretty remarkable for sort of the most recent former president to say about the current one. And I think that sort of Biden drew it home in sort of saying, like, you know, this is not a partisan moment, it's an American moment, we got to come together. And I think that that was the right set of messages for a person opposing someone like Donald Trump to have. In that sense, I think it was less partisan than your average convention. You can feel free to disagree with me on that. But anyway, that was sort of my that was my third sort of set of observations in watching.
Yeah, I would agree with some of that. I think certainly the diversity, I think, was great, especially the roll call of states and then the various tools they used for showing the Pledge of Allegiance and the national anthem and so on. Something that, like you point out, you can do in a digital convention that you can't easily do at an in-person convention.
Yep.
Now, I think that actually means it's more theater than you would have at an in-person convention, because in the in-person convention, you can only do what you can do with live people and then the short video clips. This was obviously very slickly produced, very professionally put together. something I assume we won't be seeing next week, just because
we'll see, right? Like maybe.
Yeah, but the Republicans don't have Hollywood in their pocket the way the Democrats do. You're not going to have the same number or quality of people making it. Like it's just in terms of who is supporting them and who is donating and who is involved, and the Republican runs live, so it's going to be. That it's going to be different in that sense too. At least the last I heard, they're still planning on it live.
Is Republican like it's 100% live?
I don't know. So the last I heard, and I should have looked this up. This is just poor planning on my part. The Republican one will be outdoors, and Trump won't be there for his speech, but it's still going to be in person otherwise. So.
Interesting. Okay, I should have read up myself.
That may have changed.
It's so live in that sense. Yeah. The Democratic one was essentially like a mix of live and pre-recorded, which was what led to some awkward cues and some people sort of waiting 5 seconds before it was their time to talk, that kind of thing. But nothing like what you're describing.
Right. And again, I think that the I am a fan of the live conventions just because I think they are they're more interesting. They're more fun, certainly to be there. Not that I've ever been to a national one, but they're more fun to watch. And the live conventions, the genuine kind of historic conventions other than this one, they're really for the party, right? They're aimed at the party base. The people who are delegates at the convention are your diehard voters. Like they're the people who are going to vote Democrat, even if, you know, Adolf Hitler is the candidate on the ballot. And same thing at the Republican convention.
I sure hope that's not true, but
well, yeah.
But I see what you're saying.
This convention wasn't that. This convention was functionally an 8-hour infomercial. It was clearly not aimed at the base. It was clearly not aimed at Democrat voters. It was clearly aimed at the people that they thought would be watching and tuning in. And again, that sort of general principle. So we didn't really see much in the way of policy. So if you compare this to previous conventions, and granted, in previous conventions, if you weren't watching some of the afternoon and early evening stuff, you wouldn't have seen the policy things anyways. The keynote speeches are always kind of more general, more cheerleading type things. But at least that earlier stuff was there. This time there was none of that, right? This time there was some policy, but it was a fraction of the overall convention compared to previous years. Yeah, go ahead.
I have one comment on that, Quayle, which is that I think that you're right that part of that's the effect of the compressed 8-hour infomercial nature of it.
Well, and the ability to have it prepared, right? The ability to have it all done in advance.
Sure. But I think that the other side of it, right, was the fact of like this unique moment in terms of the election. So it's actually pretty typical even for the primetime convention speeches to feature, you know, there's a joke like Hillary Clinton's speech like 4 years ago was like 56 minutes long. Right. Yeah. Joe Biden's was 24. And forgetting Hillary Clinton or the specific people there, often the convention speeches live are long. Often they are these sort of meandering, like, let me just tick through a list of sort of policy wish lists and applause lines around each of those. Right.
Right.
And so on and so forth. And you're right that part of one reason why you got less of that was because of the shorter nature of it. But I would actually argue, again, another reason you got less of it was because of the nature of the election and the sort of decision Biden or whoever made about the case he wanted to make. And the case he wanted to make was not like, yeah, I have a better healthcare plan than the other guy, right? Although I'm sure he would tell you about his healthcare plan if you were to ask him, right? The case he wanted to make was like, we are in a historic crisis where a lot of fundamental, foundational, constitutional things are at stake, and we need to like move away from that, whatever you think of me, essentially. And so if I think about the theme of Biden's speech, right, it was four crises, right?
Right.
And the four crises he named were the pandemic, the recession and the recovery that's resulting from that, the calls for racial justice that are getting more and more urgent, and then climate change, right? Now, you could say as you get towards the third and fourth items on the list, like, I'm not sure I buy into that, right? Like if you're a conservative. But nonetheless, you have to argue that like that was a choice among like the sort of long wish list of Democratic items. He highlighted four and he stuck to those.
Right.
And he kept it fairly principial, if you will, because that's, I think, the mess. So anyway, I would argue that some of the difference was that if this were 2012 and we're in the middle of a pandemic, I I feel like Barack Obama and Mitt Romney probably would have had a little more policy in their conventions, even if they were virtual. If that makes sense,
right? Well, and that's also the effect of Donald Trump,
yeah,
right?
Sure.
Which is the other component here is because of the nature of Donald Trump, all the Democrats have to do is say, "Yeah, we're just going to try to be decent human beings," and they've already got a platform that the Republicans will not be able to match with in their presidential candidate.
Yes, and that, so, in the sense of decency and empathy, for sure, for sure.
So yeah, that is also certainly the case. Now I think you could, and again, if you only have 2 hours a night, I suppose they could have done more, right? They could have had their convention be as long as they wanted it to be, but they settled on 2 hours a night. What are you going to portray, especially since your people aren't going to be the only ones there, and they're not even going to be there in person. Again, mm-hmm. it ends up being an infomercial, and I'm gonna stick with that.
It'll be interesting to see if we think the same thing is true of the Republican convention a week from now, right? Like, given that they're putting it on a little differently. So
it can't possibly be. Like, I mean, both in terms of the Republican Party is in chaos, and there's at least a live component to it that there's no way. There's no way. It's my prediction, and maybe I'm wrong. This will post the first day of the convention, so. People will know, I suppose, by the time they listen whether I'm right or not. But I think it's going to be another 4 days of praising Donald Trump like the one in 2016 was. I think it's going to be basically the same thing in maybe a slightly different format because of the pandemic. But I'll be super surprised if it's different. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe they've learned something.
The only thing I would add to that is a lot of appeals to fear. That'll be my one prediction. We'll see.
We had that in 2016 too, right? Yeah, that was statements about immigrants and statements about we're talking about the Democrats. So let's do you want to pick someone from the Democratic convention, or pick a person or a topic that you really want to highlight or emphasize?
Yeah. So let's see. So I said a little bit about Biden himself. So I guess the other one that really stands out to me is the speech that Barack Obama gave. And I think that, you know, he's known as a good speech giver. He's known as a person who sort of, you know, was a speech that launched his career, right? Like, if not for that speech, he wouldn't have been president and all that other stuff. And it was at a Democratic convention, as it were.
Yep.
I think that there was something there was something important in it around almost the existential nature. So, Coyle, if I were to make my appeal to you for why to make your vote an instrumental vote, and why yes to hold your nose and cast that ballot for, you know, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, it would be because your very ability to contest all the issues you care about depends on removing this man from the White House. Right? That's all the stuff around the Postal Service, all the stuff around like saying that if I lose the election, it'll be because it was rigged, all the stuff around essentially hinting that you're not going to accept legitimacy of the results if they go against, you know, him.
Right.
And just what we see the man do when he is sort of unshackled. So a reelected, impeached and acquitted Donald Trump will... like sort of, I don't even want to imagine what he will do in sort of his second 4 years in office, right? Like in terms of the sort of impunity with which he will act, right? Like, and the message that will send to the entire Republican Party about the meaning and the need to sort of fall in line behind this vision of America and behind this vision of the way America works, right? So I would entreat you that whatever you may think about, you know, Joe Biden and Kamala Harris and some of their sort of stances on abortion or on the Second Amendment or on any other things that you care deeply about, that your very ability to live to fight another day in a democracy that's actually going to debate those issues honestly depends on like getting this person out. And I think that was essentially the case Obama was making. Right. I'm not sure. You know what I mean? So I'm sorry. I kind of translated into me talking to you. But like, I think that was a really extraordinary moment in my mind to see him say that as sort of pointedly as he did.
Nick, I think that's a great summary of Obama's speech. I don't know that I agree that Trump is more of a threat to my ability to participate in the national conversation than the Democrats are. But
Say why.
Because I think I am more likely to be deplatformed, shut down, or have the institution I work for drummed out of existence as a bigoted institution than under the Democrats than I am under the Republicans.
So let me push on that. In what sense will those things happen to you?
Well, we
right?
saw...
Like, so your institution.
Yeah, so we saw the beginning of this under Obama, right, with the various redefinitions. So the letter that went out to public schools about transgendered bathroom usage. Under Democratic interpretations of things like Title IX, the Baptist institution I work for is going to have to decide, are we going to remain faithful to what we believe about something like gender and marriage, or are we going to allow married student housing? And
could you not simply refuse to take the federal tax subsidy?
That would be a good idea, and it's something that we should have started doing 40 years ago. At this point, like so much in American life, we are addicted to federal money. That's hopeful. I pray our administrators are doing something about that in the long term. But in the short term, like if the tap gets shut off tomorrow, and I don't think it would happen tomorrow. I think there'd be, you know, be wrapped up in the courts for a while. But I mean, there is going to be no mercy on people who believe traditional things about, and you know, fill in the blank for whatever. Both because that's the direction the Democrats were already going under Obama, and because now we're going to have the whiplash of 4 years under Trump, the reprisal for that. So, yes, I agree with you. Trump is a danger to democracy. I don't agree that the Democrats are the answer. I think they are a much more refined and polished and less crude danger to democracy.
So we've got two parties that are both dangerous to democracy.
Yes. I'm very comfortable saying that.
I do think so. Coyle, obviously, like, I'm not going to come all the way along with you on what you've said around deplatforming and free speech, right? Like, but I guess what I would say is a couple things, right? Like, I believe we often misinterpret the First Amendment when we talk about like things like, well, I'm sorry, I think that as Christians, right, we should not be surprised when the mainstream of political discussion sometimes excludes us from things like whatever, a tax subsidy in this case, right? Like, I'm like, there are things I believe. I'm kind of like, I don't expect that if like I'm in the minority and believing that it won't be surprising me. The majority of voters sort of collectively, right, vote for policies, and I don't think the Republicans are immune to this either over time.
Sure.
that are just gonna result in, like, well, guess what? Institutions or people like me, right, like, okay. Deplatforming is different because the suppressor of speech in that case is not the government.
Yep.
Right? Like, so the First Amendment just doesn't apply in that case. Sure. That's just people being mean, essentially. And unfortunately, in a free country, like, there's not a whole heck of a lot we can do about that. I'm not sure. That's more like your average rank and file, like, progressive person is responsible for that, but not the Democrats in what they enact in policy, if that makes any sense.
Right, and certainly Republicans can be jerks on social media too, right? I'm
one in particular.
Yeah, well, yeah. So we keep sure. Wandering into Republican territory.
No. The reason I say it is because I didn't just think that's a difference of degree. That is a difference of kind rather than degree in terms of threat to democracy. Like, I would agree to you that what you're describing are sort of low-grade potential threats to democracy represented by a particular party's excesses. I think at any given moment, both parties have that. I think this party, under this president, has that. it's an explicit, like, I won't recognize the results of the election kind of thing, which is what feels more existential to me, right, like in a sort of bipartisan way. So that's, again, going back to that, right. That's what I think Obama was trying to say,
And to be fair, of the big name candidates on the Democrat side who were Democratic side, who were running for president, Biden is the one that I think is sort of the least of a threat, right? Some of the lesser there are Democrats that I would have voted for had they won. Even as a conservative evangelical, I probably would have voted for Tulsi Gabbard. I probably would have voted for, you know, Michael Bennett or Steve Bullock or any number of the names that nobody knows. But of the
Tulsi's on the list, I get the other two, but yes.
Hickenlooper. There's lots of them that I would have voted for. But of the ones who are likely to win it, Biden was the kind of most acceptable of them. Now, I am assured by the Democrats that, oh, he won't really be doing the governing. It'll be his vice president. So I'm like, all right, well, that's fine. I guess that solved my problem.
I don't think that's true. I think there's something to the idea of him as a transitional figure and this vice presidential pick maybe mattering more than normal. But I'll tell you a story. I helped out with the Obama-Biden transition about what it would have been 11 years ago, right? In late 2008, early 2009. And so just whatever you volunteer, you show up to a weird nondescript building in DC, like, you know, every day for 12 hours a day to try to figure out how to get things going. And I just remember I was actually part of setting up the office that does like presidential personnel vetting. So like just making these 4,000 appointments every president has to fill when they come into office. And there's this combination of things that put people into those slots, right? It's like qualifications. It's sort of contribution of the campaign potentially. And it's also sort of who's like recommendation by one of the principals, be that the president-elect, the vice president-elect, or other future cabinet secretaries, that sort of thing. And someone was just noting like, Biden's been in this town for a long time. He's got a long list of names for like each of these positions, right? And if you believe that personnel is policy, I think what you'll find is, you know, there's obviously going to be sort of a general kind of, as all parties do, kind of looking toward the whole party for kind of who fills these jobs. But Biden knows a lot of people. He spent way too much time in this town. Anyway, so yeah. But I hear what you're saying. But yeah, so that was my take on the sort of Obama speech and the sort of existential threat warning.
Do you want to say anything else about the other keynotes? Maybe let's leave Biden's till the end. Okay. Michelle Obama, and then Bill Clinton, and Kamala Harris, and there was one other. Let me look real quick. It wasn't Hillary, although she did speak. Who was the other one? Jill Biden.
Jill Biden, that's right.
So do you want to mention any of those?
Yeah. So the Michelle Obama speech to me, it was a phenomenal speech, and I remember texting a friend of mine who knows them both and saying, you know, the first lady is going to be a tough act to follow for the president. You know, they're the former president. The person texted me like, you have no idea. But I think part of the reason for that, there's a line in her speech where she said, guys, you know, I hate politics. And she kind of can back that up in terms of like her own background and her bio. You know, kind of people wanted her to run. It's never going to happen, right? Like, that's just not what she wants to do. And I think that there was something... Again, the sort of, I haven't said much about this, and I'm saying something now. So not unlike what President Obama himself said, you know, but similarly, the similar themes of kind of existential threat, right, as it were. I think, if I think about, well, so Bill Clinton, I don't know if it's classified as a keynote. I'm glad it was blessedly short, 5 minutes only. If those of us who lean left are to be consistent, you know, sort of the demands of kind of Me Too sort of suggest that, like, we need, you know, like, I think that was the closest that the Democrats could have come to deplatforming him, as it were, right? Like, you know, and I think that's actually appropriate, you know, much as he's a person of political talent and whatever else, right? Like, clearly some deep flaws in his background.
Well, there's a couple of ways to approach it, because he specifically talked about, you know, occupying the Oval Office with dignity and decency. And I think there's a couple of ways to interpret that. You could say, oh, you know, what a raging hypocrite, which would be, you know, right. But you could also say, even Bill Clinton says, man, that's too far, which would also be right. So
that is true. And it's funny. The irony here is Biden's saying a lot about restoring decency and honor to the White House. George W. Bush said that in 2000, yep, in that campaign, right? Like, we all knew what he was talking about. Like,
sure.
And then I think the Jill Biden thing. So I'll group the Jill Biden speech just in the general category of sort of biographical information about Joe Biden, if you will, right? So there was the sort of love story of the two of them, his own background, and then a bunch of stuff on the last night leading up to his speech that's about, like, who is Joe Biden? Like, who is his family? What is this stuff? And I guess the one thing I'd say to that is it was a relief to think about and get a look inside the life of this person who's going to be the nominee for, you know, the highest office in the land, and to see sort of that he values family, to see that he knows something about what it is to deal with grief, to sort of have a kind of plain human story, as it were. One of the remarkable things about Donald Trump is it's like kind of who are his friends and who is he close to and who does he value, right? And in a weird, strange way, you could say maybe that about his wife, his children.
His children.
Different. Yeah, certainly.
His children. None of his wives, but his children.
Yeah. And I think that there's just, I think that, you know, this idea that a person who just kind of shares my values, shares my experiences, like, I think that was kind of what I took away from sort of anybody who was family, right? Kind of thinking about that stuff.
I think that's a good point, actually. So the contrast, so much time was spent on Joe Biden's family, like the family that has passed away. You know, he's experienced a lot of death in his immediate family, his wife, his child, and the family that he still has. His interactions with them, clearly a loving and dedicated and self-sacrificial father, It's a great point of contrast with Donald Trump, who also clearly loves his children. Yeah. I don't think there's any doubt about that. But even that, and maybe they'll talk about this next week, I don't know. I don't get the impression that it is a self-sacrificial love. It's a, I love you because you are my children. You carry my name, and you're sort of an extension of me. I don't see Donald Trump taking the train hours to get home every night to spend time with his kids, right? Maybe he did. Maybe I'm wrong, and maybe that's I'm being unfair there, and I'm letting my view of his virtue seep into a place where it shouldn't. But Trump seems to love his kids at the expense of everyone else. Biden seems to love his kids. If it's at anyone's expense, it's at his own.
Yeah. I mean, actually, it's funny. People commented. One thing they'll note is people commented that the introduction of Joe Biden was sort of, you know, Beau had the last word, sort of a recording of him. But his two living children, including Hunter, right, the boogeyman of the right,
yep,
still there. And I think the commentary I saw on the left there was simply, he kind of doesn't care if he takes a hit for it. That's his son and he loves him. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And obviously didn't have a huge role, right? But like, but even that was, it was meaningful in the fact that it even happened, right? And I think that is a sort of teeny weeny version of what you're just describing about like sacrificial love, I think.
Yeah. And again, clearly a dedicated family man. Anything else you want to say about his family? Otherwise,
no.
I want to talk about the Republicans who were there.
Yep. Oh, okay. Yeah, sure.
So we saw Kasich, Governor Kasich, former Governor Kasich. Notable because he was governor of Ohio in 2016 when the Republican convention was in Cleveland,
and
he didn't go. Someone asked if he was going to go, and he said he's going to be home mowing his lawn. Christine Todd Whitman, the former governor of New Jersey and former head of the EPA under Bush. And then I forget who the third one was. There was a third Republican that was featured, and I'm just blanking on it.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I'm not going to remember either. There were a lot of sort of rank and file mixed in there too, in addition to like the big names.
Right. Well, Bloomberg was there, but he's kind of
all over the map. Sure.
Yeah. I'm a little surprised Trump didn't name him as running mate for 2020, frankly. But
Bloomberg wouldn't have done it, I don't think.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm sort of the networks that I'm in suggest there's no way it would have happened.
All right.
Yeah.
So do you think we're going to be seeing any Democrats at next week's convention?
That's a good question.
I mean, I think the answer is probably no.
I mean, I'm sure that you can find someone, right? Like, it just is.
Well, they had some in 2016. Yeah. Like, they had a few, but
yeah, I'm trying to think. None that we've sort of heard of, right? Like, unless you count like Kanye West or something, right? Like. Seriously, right? Like, if he's, you know, like being promoted as a spoiler candidate or whatever else, and
sure. What did you think about the what did you think about these Republicans who were speaking there?
I guess I just want to say, I've got a lot of friends, including you, Coyle, right, who are lifelong conservatives, maybe lifelong Republicans, if nothing else, interested in the Republican Party as a vehicle for conservatism and the conservative movement.
Sure, sure.
And I have to just say, like, I'm, you know, in, even as I'm saying all these, you know, things where I really don't like Donald Trump and think he's a threat and all that, I really feel for my friends who are in those circles, especially the ones who had aspirations of potentially running for office one day and who, for reasons of conscience, right, like feel like they can't now in this party, right, in this right. sort of place. The sense I get is that if you're one of those people, a lifelong kind of movement person, Republican person, whatever it is, you're really struggling with kind of what do you do and where do you position yourself and what's the future of this party as this vehicle. And so I want to say, like, I guess that, like, it takes courage to. I don't want to downplay the courage it would have taken to sort of make an appearance. Even if you're someone like Christine Tom Whitman and you're sort of semi-retired, it's been years, yeah. whatever. Even then, right? Like, you've spent your life in Republican politics, right? Like, you've spent your life at the other party's conventions, you know. And I think that so I'm grateful for people who I think essentially have made or are making the same argument Barack Obama made, which is like, this is bigger than party. Like, who knows what I'm gonna vote for 4 years from now, but I know that we have to get Donald Trump out of office now. And I right. think that actually, if you're to rebuild the Republican Party in a better image, you have like that's the logical thing to do, is to actually say, hand the reins to the party that isn't going crazy right now, right? Like, and then use that defeat as a platform for rebuilding the party in a different image. So I was, and I mean, you know, for sure, were some of them more self-interested in appearing than others? I'm sure they were, right? Like, you know, especially if you're someone like Kasich, who like, this kind of always been your brand to be a little bit more moderate, et cetera, to that sort of thing. But again, at the end of the day, I was grateful for every Republican that showed up to the convention to sort of give that same message.
So let's talk about Joe Biden's speech. What did you think about it?
Yeah. So I already kind of talked a bit about the four crises, and I thought that was a
sure.
I thought that was a good choice. If you think about sort of concentric circles of like, you know, sort of Democratic preferences and then sort of American things, it's like kind of a half and half. It's like sort of pandemic. Yep, we all agree that's a crisis. Like recession, we all agree that's
many people.
Yeah,
many
I'm sorry, people. Sorry, fair enough.
There are those cranks
yeah,
out there.
So pandemic, then recession, then racial justice. Actually, I think even, again, that probably brings in more people than just Democrats, right? And then climate change, that's the hardest one, right? And yet, still, right? Like, if you're going to choose something because you really believe it's big and important, right? So it wasn't like, oh, we want to reverse those tax cuts, or, oh, what, you know, we want a healthcare plan. Those, they're, you know, go to the website, there's plenty of stuff about those things, right? But
right.
Those are the four things. I think so. Number one, I thought that was a wise choice, and I thought it was sort of the message that the country probably needed from its opposition candidate, like, you know, sort of this time around. I thought that the sort of there was a show. Not, well, I've talked about those themes of empathy and the sort of not only he talk about it, but the show not tell nature of it, right? So there are these stories about Joe Biden because he has experienced so much loss, right? That whenever he meets somebody who has experienced a loss, he'll be like, here's my number, call me, no really, right? And he'll check up on those people because he feels a deep bond. And he extended that in a way that made sense for the current moment, right? There was a line in the speech where he said, for those of you who have lost people to this virus, right? And I want you to know I feel your pain. I know what that's like, and it's terrible. Someone referred to the fact that, like, sometimes there is a so-called priestly role of the presidency, as it were, right? Like, right. Someone asked, you know, Donald Trump to play that role, and like it's just not something he's good at, right? Like, I mean, you know, say, so like, what do you say to the people who are suffering? And he says, I think that's a terrible question, the media's out to get me, etc., right? Like, that's his answer to a question like
right.
that. And so to show that kind of empathy and to say, like, this is a time for pulling together and healing, we're in an unprecedented time, I thought that was positive. And then I guess the last thing I'll say is the chatter on the left during that speech was sort of a, well, the Trump campaign probably should not have pinned its hopes on the idea that, like, Joe Biden can't deliver a speech, right? Which is sort of some of the stuff that, I mean, again, the campaign, I think, has different messages coming out of it. One of the messages was sort of like, hey, he's senile, he's doddering, and he can't deliver a speech. It's funny, one person sort of pointed out that Joe Biden's always been like this, even before he was 78, even when he was like 35. And as an exhibit, they submitted an article from, I want to say it was the 90s. It was like a New Yorker article. And it was literally just a reprint of a statement of his at a Senate committee hearing. And it was like a single run-on sentence that went on for like three pages. And so it's like, ah, this is who he's always been, like good or bad, right? It's funny. There's a quote from him in 2018 when he says, "I know I'm a gaffe machine." But isn't that better than someone who like can't even bother to try to tell the truth? And I think that like those things all sort of came together in that evening, and it was probably one of the best speeches he's ever given. Right? He's not like the greatest orator ever, but I felt like he did what needed to be done, and I was grateful for that too.
Yeah, and I will admit I couldn't tell whether it was live or recorded while he was delivering it, and I think that's to his credit because it was live. To his credit, and I suppose to the Democratic convention's credit for letting him do that, because the temptation to get that recorded early had to have been powerful.
Sure.
Like, earlier in the day, give him a chance to mess up. Like,
yep. I think they wanted to disprove whatever rumor, you know, stuff there was out there about, like, he can't give a speech or, you know, whatever. Yeah.
Now, I think we're still owed some debates. Like, if you want America to heal, we need to see Donald Trump debate Joe Biden.
Yeah.
I deserve that, Nick.
You deserve that. that's the junkie in you coming out. But
yeah, it really is. these two inarticulate old men going at each other is...
Septuagenarians, right, Coyle? Like,
yes. Whoever wins is going to be our oldest president. Trump is already our oldest elected president.
Right. I know.
So Biden might beat his record, but
I know. I find that sad. I always found that sad. I found that sad for like the last 10 years as a sort of older millennial who is like sick and tired of being ruled by his parents' generation. Like I'm tired of that.
Oh, I don't mind that. Not least because I guess I don't really think of Obama as being my parents' generation. I suppose
he was a skip in the beat. He was younger, right? But literally, the last three presidents were all born within a few months of each other in the summer of 1946. Right. The last three of the four, other than Obama, were all born in that year.
Right.
So.
Right, and I'm fine with that. I think having an older president is probably a good idea, so long as that age comes with experience and wisdom and all of that. I don't know that we've had that for a while. and I mean, there's a lot of other things that have been missing. It's been a while since we've had a military veteran, combat veteran in office. It's been a while since.
Yep.
Anyway, that a lot of that. But I think you're right about Biden. It was a good speech. It was generally... an appeal for decency. Mm-hmm. Your four crises. I mean, that's exactly right. And I think again, given the nature of this convention as an online commercial, he didn't have to go into any detail, right? He didn't have to say, you know, what are we going to do to fight climate change? Well, we're going to, you know, choke coal off at the throat. He didn't have to say anything like that because it's not speaking just to the base.
Right.
He could say it generally and then leave it for people to fill in a way that's acceptable to everyone else, that's acceptable to the listener, that maybe we'll get a few votes from the other side. Maybe not. I don't know. I genuinely don't know who's going to win the election, and I wouldn't try to predict.
But, yeah, me neither.
Anything else about Biden's speech or the convention overall?
Just that, like, I think I stand by what I said at the beginning. I prefer the infomercial.
But Nick, don't you miss the impromptu one-liners that are just done for applause that they have to apologize for, and the Bernie lunatics disrupting things, and someone ignorantly waving a Cuban flag? I mean, don't you miss that? Like,
well, I mean, I guess. What, it's funny, you said something earlier about how, like, because it's an infomercial, like, they're talking more to a general election audience than to the base, right? But I think that conventions throughout the modern era have always attempted to do that because they know, right? Like, they're going to be covered in primetime by all the networks. It's the one time they get to do that. It's like, and so if anything, they're struggling to not let those other things get out, right? Like, and you're right. The infomercial meant
sure. Oh,
less
yeah.
of the less of the basiness of the party getting out, as it were, right? I think that I guess what I'd say is the question is, I guess the genuine question is, like, how much do we want, like you think about it, think about the other stuff that goes on around a convention,
you mean,
right?
Like protests and riots and stuff.
Protests, riots, like random sort of meetings of interest groups, like sort of a
sure.
Pass a party platform that no one actually reads, you know, like, you know, there's these things that happen that are sort of, I think, you know, there. One thing I'll say about the pandemic generally is it forces us to ask ourselves which of the things we were doing before turned out to be totally unnecessary. And I think it's just worth, you know, so maybe 4 years from now, it won't be the same infomercial, but I bet it won't be like 2016 either. Do you know what I mean? Like, and I think that that's probably a good thing. Like, if you think about, like even like going back to the roll call of states thing, right? Like, some of those guys were live and some of them were pre-recorded. They had a choice. So there was actually a bit of a weird, there was actually a bit of an AV feat you had to pull off and like getting all that to work, et cetera. But there was something, you actually learned a little bit more sure. about the diversity of our country. And I don't mean that in a Democratic or Republican sense of it. I think if the Republicans do the same thing, it will be similarly illuminating, actually, right? Like,
except it'll look like copying, right? It'll look like they just stole it from
the Democrats. Fair enough. Yeah, that's true. But but if you think about the way that those roll calls worked at the live conventions, it was kind of like, you know, it's sort of like in the hallway. It didn't really have a lot of significance.
But you also have that chance for someone to, you know, change the vote. Right, you're never going to have the opportunity for someone to try to throw a wrench into things.
For decades, right? Like every year,
it's true. It was the 70s, right? It was the last time.
I guess that's the other thing I'd say, Quill. Conventions like that made sense when we genuinely had to like contest the outcome, either because there were no primary elections or because the primary elections like left room for ambiguity, right, or whatever else, like. But we haven't lived in that world in yours and my like modern political lifetimes, not really.
I mean, to be fair, if not for the pandemic, there is a real chance the Democratic primary could have ended there this year.
That's true. We were all one. It was a bit miraculous that Joe Biden just sort of suddenly started winning all the primaries, right? Like, it ever so slightly predates the pandemic that some weird results started happening, right? Like Super Tuesday and some other. You're like, what is this, right? Like that was a little unusual. It was sort of tough to not tough to explain, but it was surprising to all of us. So you're right. It could have ended up that way. Yeah.
Right. Now I don't know that it would have because the Klobuchar and Buttigieg and all of those folks dropped out before they could have really divided the vote.
Yeah.
But and I suspect there was backroom wheeling and dealing since some of them dropped out after winning states.
And by the way, it's funny. So one thing I didn't tell you, so quite like Biden wasn't my first choice either. My first choice was actually Buttigieg. He and I went to grad school together. And so it was everything I've said about the generational bit, right? Like around like the sort of like and, you know, the only one of two veterans, right, who was running. The other one was Tulsi, right? And I remember being really proud of him when he dropped out. He was the first to drop out. And it was sort of like he knew when to fold him, and he, like, let the dominoes fall where everyone else dropped out, right? And that was kind of part of what led to Biden being, you know, the nominee. And by the way, Quill, I guess if I could bookend what I've been saying throughout this hour with you with that, I do think that says something about the party, though I no longer would call myself a full-throated defender of it or, like, a, you know, sort of a registered Democrat, et cetera.
Right.
That was how they resolved their contest vis-a-vis what happened 4 years ago on the Republican side, right? Like if you think about sort of the like and that tells you something about one side versus the other, but it also tells you something about the moment today, is that even these folks were like, this is existential, we can't have a contested primary. And so a couple of them were like, I'm going all in with Joe Biden because right, yeah.
That's the generous spin, of course. The less generous spin is they were all told they had to or bought off.
Potentially. I mean, I don't.
Which is, you know, more in line with what we saw on the Democrat side in 2016 with the behind the scenes putting things
in favor of Hillary, that really did happen, for sure. I think with this one, it was too messy and splintered for it to be something that, like, I mean, because Biden, until he started winning, it looked like he was going to lose, right? He was raising less money than everybody else. Oh, like, he was like...
I don't think anyone thought Biden was going to lose. It was going to be how much is he going to have to work to win, right? How hard was the field going to be?
Interesting. I think the perception that I had from watching the primary was it felt like a mess. I was in despair. It's true that Biden had a polling lead that people like downplayed essentially, right? As they were looking at emails, other people were raising their money. And then finally, when votes started getting cast, other than a couple of the early contests, it was Biden, Biden, Biden. And so there it was, right? And so, yeah, I think you're right about that.
Well, and again, I'm an old man at heart enough that I would go back to deciding this stuff at the convention. Like, I think that's that sort of working is better than trying to hammer it out through primaries. But that's a different discussion. I'm radically anti-primary. But again, that's...
I hear you and I understand that. And every time I go through a primary, every time I watch a primary, it makes me a little bit more radically anti-primary. So of either party.
Hey, there is something to be said for smoke-filled rooms. Donald Trump would never have been president if the Republicans still had their smoke-filled rooms. But
true. Yeah.
And Hillary Clinton might have been earlier. You know, Barack Obama might never have been president either.
Yep.
Well, anything else out of the convention?
No.
Do you feel like you wasted 8 hours of your life?
You know, I'll be honest. I watched it while I was like doing work or whatever else, right? Like in the evening. So like I was not like glued to the screen. I'm not clear I would have actually literally given 8 uninterrupted full attention hours of my life to anything like this. But that's partly because of just the way I consume information. I thought it was informative to understand the choices that the party and the leadership and Joe Biden himself made about what kind of case they wanted to make. The convention does, if nothing else, for either party, represent a choice that ultimately the nominee is making about what they want to say, right? And that will be true next week too. So we should literally ask ourselves a question, like, what did it tell us about what the nominee wanted to say, right? There's actually, I will point your readers to the failing liberal New York Times. There was an article that posted just a day or two ago, and it was basically just a roundup of like kind of how Biden won, and it was essentially saying that from the beginning Biden knew what he wanted to say, right? And there's a story he told in the speech, and the story that has been told before about how the moment for him was Charlottesville, of sort of I watched what happened. The president say there were fine people on both sides, you know, and refer to white supremacists in the same sentence as, you know, the others. And he said that was the moment that I knew I needed to run, right? And I think that the story in this New York Times article kind of paints it as when consultants came to him and said, run on something else, he repeatedly would say, no, this is what I'm running on. Decency, restoration, a return to normal. Right. I don't care what y'all think. And I will say this convention reflected that ethos, didn't it? Right. And it was sort of in that sense, it was Joe Biden's like.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm tempted to ask you if you want to predict the outcome of 2020. But, man, I wouldn't want to be on record about that. So I won't ask you to either. I will say rather predictively, reflectively. It seems, and this may also be because of the nature of the convention where it's all online. Biden did not get the convention bounce in the polls. That is often the case after conventions. Normally, what happens is after a convention, you get a small spike in the polls, like 5% or something. I mean, it's pretty minor, and it's usually gone by the end of the next week. But Biden didn't even get that. So Biden is ahead of Trump in the polls. He is not as much ahead as Hillary Clinton was at the same time last year, and he didn't get that bounce after the convention. Now, I am comfortable predicting Trump won't get it next week either. Mm. I think Trump will stay at 40%, which is where he's been for 4 years now. But that should be troubling for Biden, right? The fact that a week of trying to show decency and trying to show kind of a general platform or a general message that's intended to appeal to everyone – it doesn't seem to have worked, maybe because no one was watching. There fewer people tuned in this year too.
I'd agree with you that I don't know, right, how effective it was or how much it mattered or how many persuadable people there are left out there right now. I would also agree with you that I don't know who's going to win. I think it would be foolish to think that, like, you know, I actually, If any of you follow Nate Silver, his model came out and it made a bit of a splash because it predicted that Biden had a 72% chance of winning or something like that. It's been hovering around there for a while. And what was remarkable about it was it's significantly lower, actually, than all the other forecasters that are out there right now. And he said, look, that's basically the odds we gave Hillary 4 years ago. And we stand by that, right? Like 69, 70% means one time out of three, like it's going to go the other way. And I think that like that's true. One of the things that actually bothers me on just a personal note is the fact that this president can be the type of person he is and get a pass on so many things, right? And still, basically, a little bit of good news in late October, early November evens this up.
Yep.
Right? Like, it's like watching the stock market. You're like, okay, we'll see. You know, yeah. Like, and all the mismanagement, all the particularly terrible things he's done in these last several months as regards handling these crises will be sort of erased because of the durability of his base vote. And because, yeah, it's just really close. It's been close in that sense. So I would say that, like, I do believe our democracy depends on it. And for that reason, like, I want to be vigilant and not complacent about what's out there. And to your listeners, I would say, consider living to fight another day with a better champion than this one by getting this guy out, you know, for the causes that you care the most about.
Well, we'll talk more about this next week. That's probably a good place to leave it. Nick, thanks so much for coming on the show. And I look forward to talking with you and maybe with someone else about the Republican convention in 1 week. Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning into the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippic. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting ChristianHumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/City of Man Podcast, or get in touch with us at CityofManPodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high